Leaders inspire loyalty, or they should. When you connect with the people you work with and manage, they'll give their best and endure the hard times. If, on the other hand, there's no trust or consideration of the everyday stress of the job, that can build and become toxic. Michael Stallard is author of Connection Culture, The Competitive Advantage of Shared Identity, Empathy, and Understanding at Work. He joins me now with tips on how you can grow a connection culture at your agency. Mr. Stallard, great to have you on.
Good morning, Tom. It's great to be with you.
All right, so it's an eternal question, but everybody has to learn it on their own, I guess. How do you create that shared vision that is greater than yourself and get people to buy into it?
Well, it's finding how the work of the group connects to people, how it helps people. I think of Admiral Vern Clark, who is the CNO in the Navy from 2000 to 2005. And when he came in, the Navy was not meeting its reenlistment goals for enlisted sailors. Their goal is 38%, and they were under that. And one of the things Admiral Clark did, especially in the area of vision, was he talked about, you know, we're people of service. We serve a cause greater than self. And he laid out a plan to really change the Navy to make it faster, more responsive. And I think people just sensed his commitment to that, and it made a difference, along with the other things he did. And it boosted their first-term reenlistment in 18 months from under 38% to close to 57%.
And that brings up a question. You've probably heard the standard leadership speech line that I've heard it many times over the years. People say they feel, leaders of large organizations often say they feel like they're standing in a graveyard. There's lots of people beneath them, but they can't sure anybody hears. And so if you are near the top, or you lead a organization of a lot of people that you may not know personally or may not be able to get to personally, how can you connect with them even if the connection isn't direct?
Well, what's important for leaders at the top, Tom, is to be intentional about subcultures, because every organization has three types of subcultures. One is the subculture of control, where those who have power, control, rule the rest. Then there's the subculture of indifference, where people are just so busy, they don't take time to build supportive relationships. And the best subculture is a subculture of connection, where people feel connected to their supervisors, to the people they work with, to the mission of the group. And those things make a difference. They actually have a biological effect on us. Everything from affecting neurotransmitters in our brains, hormones throughout our body, and the allocation of blood, glucose, and oxygen so that we feel safe, or whether we're in the stress response, that kind of shuts down our productivity.
Because if you have a great leader, for example, but the relationship is hub and spoke, everybody relates to the leader, can that also maybe harm the ability of people to relate horizontally, which is really the strength of the day-to-day kind of work environment that people encounter?
Yeah, that's a very good point you make. It's important for leaders to understand where those critical connections lie within the organization across silos, to really map out performance and understand where they lie and be intentional about creating connection across those silos for the sake of the group's performance.
And, of course, in private sector organizations, business conditions can make things difficult, and they eventually will, no matter where you work. In federal and public sector organizations, political pressures, budget pressures also make things tough. How does a leader maintain his or her own positivity and make sure that people stay positive when there's good reason to worry?
Well, that's why this is a good point to just step back and talk a little bit about how culture affects biology. And when we feel threatened, when we feel under stress, the body moves into a stress response so that blood, glucose, and oxygen is allocated to the heart, the lungs, the big muscles. The body is anticipating the need to fight or flee the threat. At the same time, it underallocates blood, glucose, and oxygen to the parts of the brain, the digestive system, the immune system, so we're more vulnerable to sickness and disease. And so in times where people fear job loss, when they're struggling with adversity, which all organizations and individuals face, we need those supportive relationships, Tom, that help make us feel safe. And that's true of leaders, too. It's true of every employee. And those threats may come from the context at work, whether it's budget cuts that threaten our jobs, or it may be just the challenges we face in life. You know, it could be loss of a loved one or sickness or divorce. We have these challenges, and we just need those connections to help us thrive in life, to get through those tough times. But they also, I love what Matthew Lieberman, the neuroscientist at UCLA, says. He describes connection as a superpower because it makes us more productive, happier, and healthier. And that is just so true. So it's important for leaders to understand that they need to be intentional about creating these cultures of connection.
We're speaking with Michael Stallard. He's the author of Connection Culture, The Competitive Advantage of Shared Identity, Empathy, and Understanding at Work. So it sounds like even in tough times, maybe it's incumbent on the leader to do things, even maybe spend a little money, to create this bond that that makes the blood and the sugar, you know, be where they should for the best feeling among people, which might be counterintuitive in tough situations.
Well, that's when I think there's the greatest benefit. When organizations face diversity, it helps. I like to say it transforms a dog-eat-dog culture into a sled dog team that pulls together. It's kind of a simple illustration, but you get the idea that when the team pulls together, then we get through obstacles. If they don't, then we really shoot ourselves in the foot. So, and our broader society today is becoming a lonelier culture. So people are coming to work with a connection deficit. And especially you see with the millennials, they're number one. Well, I think of there was a survey a couple years ago, 7,000 millennials worldwide. Their number one value was connection. But they're not necessarily experiencing it. So there's a sense of frustration about longing for this desire to be met, but not experiencing it, including not experiencing it in the workplace.
Well, maybe they should take their earbuds out and they could connect with people more.
Well, that certainly helps. That's certainly one of the issues. But I think, you know, families have moved around. If you know, this started to become a problem. Loneliness started to increase post-World War II. And when you step back and look at the big trends, Tom, you see that families moved around the country to pursue economic opportunities. There were more the parents and the family were working, and that created some disconnection in the family. People are spending more time commuting, working longer hours, all those things combined, along with what you cite, which is more engaging media, including the media that's available on our smartphones, have just taken away from time for face-to-face connection.
And in your book, you mentioned some examples of great leaders and the band U2, which has been together for decades. How does that work?
Well, you know, that's a fascinating story, Tom. It's the story of four boys who were 14 and 15-year-old when they started. And when they started, people laughed at them and booed them at times. I think they were amusing to watch, but they didn't necessarily sound great. But now, today, they've won more Grammy Awards than any band in history. They've surpassed the Rolling Stones for the highest revenue-producing tour in history. And when you look at their leadership, Bono, who is the leader, or the de facto leader, I would call him. I'm not sure he would admit to being the leader, but when you study them, he's definitely the leader. And he's the lyricist and lead singer. And you could describe his leadership in this way. He communicates an inspiring vision and lives it. He values people and gives them a voice, and that creates the connection. And when you go back and look at those pieces, vision, value, and voice, the band's vision is to write music that promotes human rights and social justice, and Bono lives it. Bono and his wife, Allie, they've created several philanthropies that raise money to fight poverty, particularly in Africa. When you look at how he's valued the members of the band, about a year after the band was formed, Larry Mullen Jr., the drummer, his mother was hit and killed in a car accident, and Bono reached out to him and helped him get through a tough time because Bono had lost his mother just a couple years earlier. And then a few years after that, when the band started to get some traction, they got their first recording contract offer. But there was a condition, Tom, that they drop Larry because he's an unconventional drummer. And Bono told the record company executive basically to shove it because, you know, he had Larry's back. And he told them that it was all of us or none of us. And it wasn't an easy decision to make because they needed the money. And
sure.
They, of course, wanted the opportunity. And then, so those are just some examples of how we see they value one another. And then finally, they have a voice in decisions that are made. If any one of the four core members and their manager strongly opposes a particular decision, then they won't go there. It forces them to work through their disagreements to reach a consensus or near consensus. And it takes more time. It's frustrating, but they believe it produces better results. And when you look at their results, it's hard to argue with that.